Chapter 21. Tyrker had not the reasons for patience that let the rest of the crew wait endlessly. Their homes were here, beyond the edge of the world. His was in the Styrian Mountains. He had already forced too much patience upon himself. He suddenly found it intolerable to sit here for a single extra second of his life, waiting upon his master's whim. Master? He, Tyrker, was master now, because he was so desperately needed. He owned the Sea King, not the other way around, and resented this strange new hesitancy, deeming it a sort of rebellion. He determined to run the cause to Earth and speed them all upon the way he had planned, himself to his freedom, his companions to their death. Now he began to watch his master, taking care he did not seem to be doing so, and became aware of the frequent lonely walks and the day-long absences. These had drawn no one's attention up to then, since the Sea King's lifelong habit of thinking out problems during a solitary stroll was well known. It was held to be one source of his infallibility. Tyrker alone refused to accept this easy explanation, his fixed purpose letting him take nothing for granted. He re-examined each detail to be certain he was seeing clearly. He thus enabled himself to notice that when his master's steps neared the wood, they quickened in a way that did not bespeak the tranquility of thought. He noticed, too, that the walks began earlier each day and ended later. Finally, he followed him. Keeping a long, safe distance between them, he crawled stealthily from rock to bush, choosing to lose sight of his quarry rather than be seen by him. He did lose sight of him the first few times, so overly cautious was he, but his skill grew with practice, until one day, having clung to him until they were well within the woods, he saw at last, and understood. He had only one swift glimpse through an opening in the underbrush. Then he put his head down and lay flat upon the ground, listening, but fearing to look again lest he be seen, though man and girl were so intent upon each other that he could have been bolder and yet safe. In that instant, he had seen how lovely the girl was, and a wave of bitter envy swept through him. When he heard the Sea King's tender, desperate avowals, heard him swear that he would come back, that nothing should keep them apart, he knew the oath would be kept if it were possible for a man to keep it. Throughout the entire day, he remained thus, wretched because of the cold ground, listening, envying, and silent. Only when night was at hand and the lovers had gone, did he venture to return to camp. His absence had caused no alarm because of his previous safe return. When they saw him approaching, it was assumed that he had been exploring again, according to his own odd notions, and would presently astonish them with whatever he had found. Tyrker was glad to let them think that, fostering their mistake with a wink and a sly smile, and was thus able to go undisturbed about his own vindictive business. In his hut, brooding over what he had learned, it was the girl's beauty that continued to torment him. He would not let himself believe that she had bestowed herself on the man he so deeply hated. But since he had been contradicted in this by his own eyes, he consoled himself by deciding she was not human. The Sea King had so decided, too, with the difference that he had made her more than a human, a goddess. His thrall turned her into something less, a troll, an Al-Elamia. Enchanting their leader by unholy spells to halt their voyage and Olaf's sacred vengeance. The way to offset the sorcery was to kill the sorceress. When his free companions had first begun to accept him as an equal and thought he could be trusted with weapons, he had made himself a bow and some arrows. The bow was of a strange design. It was shorter than the kind known to the Norse and English, and it curved differently from theirs, turning back upon itself at the ends like the horns of a wild eastern ox. It was really meant to be used on horseback and had been imported into his native land from Cathay and Khorasan, where small, strong horses carried the swift-riding marksmen who in time would sweep across Europe. The Icelanders smiled when they saw the dwarfish weapon, but Tyrker liked the feel of it even without a horse to ride, since it lessened his homesickness a little. It seemed to him now that fate had guided his hand in shaping it, for its small size would let it be wielded freely amid the low-lying branches of the forest. The arrow for his purpose needed to be an unusual one. This was no human being he was going to hunt. He bethought himself of his amulet, his silver crucifix that had been a ring on Thor's finger. Unsuspected by the heathen in whose midst he lived, he had prayed to it secretly, as fervently as once he had to river spirits or the moon, that it would help him square accounts with his captors. Now, as he prayed to it once again by the firelight in his hut, it seemed to gleam with more than its customary brightness, and he had his answer. He melted it, shaped it to a needle-sharp point, and tipped an arrow with it. Then he was satisfied. No witch's spell could ward off that. He could not sleep, thinking of what it could do. The magic arrow delighted him. All through the night he gloated over it, admiring it, balancing it, saying fresh prayers to make it more potent. Part of his prayer was that when he went down to the lovers' meeting place, the girl should be there alone. If she were not, he was prepared to try again and yet again until all was as he wished it. He was newly supplied with patience, the combined patience of the hunter and the zealot. He would have gone to the wood in the middle of the night and waited, to be sure at least that the Sea King slept, but for fear of wild beasts that the darkness might hide. With the very earliest glimmer of dawn, he was out and away to the wood, so carefully and quietly that none of the camp's guards saw or heard him. He carried his bow, with his silver-tipped arrow, ready for its magic target and his other arrows for anything else. When he reached the spot where he had lain and listened the day before, he lay and listened again. For a long time, or what seemed a long time, he heard only the sounds of birds and small creatures, bestirring themselves to meet the day. He forced himself to be motionless, so as to not disturb them and have their cries of alarm signal his presence. Presently, their twittering grew louder and more excited, which told him that someone was approaching. Fright seized him at the thought that the man and girl might be together and this time perhaps find him. He had a terrified impulse to kill them both, and dreamed swiftly and wildly of seizing command of the ship and sailing it into Olaf's arms. He had sense enough to stifle this plan, born of panic, remembering that his bargain with the priest was to bring the Icelanders to him, not kill them, and a hasty look through the shrubbery showed him that his prayer was granted. The girl was alone. He was trembling so violently that his shaking hand could scarcely find the silver-tipped arrow. He managed to draw it from the quiver, setting it to the bow as he rose to his feet. He stepped toward her, aiming. The twigs cracked as he pressed through them, and she turned toward the sound with a glad cry, expecting her lover. She stopped short, not in fear but in astonishment, to find herself looking at death. She knew it was that, by the face of the man who brought it. He still shivered, uncontrollably, throughout his whole body, but she was so near he could not miss. He let the arrow fly and heard the thud as it hit her bosom. For a moment, she remained standing. They looked at each other, both of them feeling more of surprise than anything else at what had happened. Then she fell without a cry. Turker's trembling suddenly ceased. He felt eased, light, oddly happy. It was not at all like having furthered this revenge. It felt more as if he had satisfied his desire. Without casting another look at her, he stole back to camp, as cautiously and secretly as he had left. No one saw or heard him, or knew he had been away, but he almost wished they had. His heart was bounding with joy. If he had dared to make any sound at all, he would have sung. His pleasure was the more intense because he was safe. No one could possibly know who had killed her, if indeed any but the Sea King knew she had ever been alive. The arrow was not, of necessity, his. It was feathered from one of the birds that made their homes there, the same whose plumage adorned the girl's own dress. Nor was he in any danger from the sorceress herself. His sacred amulet was in her heart, making her powerless to take revenge on him. Unable to cast any spell whatever on anyone, or to forestall their journey back to Christendom. In his hut, he lay down for the sleep he had foregone, justified, free of fear, calm. Nonetheless, when the Sea King found the dead girl, he knew at once who had killed her. That knowledge, by thrusting itself in the way of his pain, helped him bear it. It was the story of Hakon and Kark that made him sure. It sprang to the surface of his consciousness, shouting the Slayer's name. Turker. He hates you because you own him. Nothing can change that. It had been madness to think that master and slave could be truly side by side for whatever purpose. As he knelt beside her, he again saw the white-clad group of thralls whispering in the darkness outside his house. Turker. He would kill him, more dreadfully than anyone was ever killed. Presently. Now he clasped her stiffening hand and allowed himself no thought but of her. His grief was not merely that of a man for a dead sweetheart. She was much more than a woman. She was the last goddess, the last proof of a once great faith, as he was its last worshiper, and hers. Some men think, and even say, that they love as no man ever did before. Of the Sea King, it might at least be said that he loved as no man ever did after him. The changing world forbade it. Gods and people were thenceforth to be separated from one another, as aloof as the sky and earth which are their separate homes. Their difference, rather than their sameness, was what mattered, so much so that there would have to be priests to explain them to each other. As to any possibility of love between them, it would only be of a mystical, unearthly kind, inconceivable to people who had none but human experience. As she lay there, she was as pallid as himself, looking much more like any dead woman than the goddess he knew her to be. He drew the arrow from her heart to keep forever, then kissed her and said goodbye, though he knew she could no longer hear him. None of the gods could hear him. They were all dead, as he had long known in his soul. The great battle of Ragnarok had been lost. It was being fought when he crossed the ocean, and the Thing was held in Iceland to drive Odin and his kin from their thrones. The dearest of that bright host had fled to Wineland to await him. With her gone, he could no longer deny that the great doom had fallen. The goodbye, which he said to her and to all of them, was forever. The worlds of here and hereafter alike held no promise of a future meeting. Valhall and Asgard were in ruins, and all the heroes' ghosts without a home. He covered her with a mound of earth and stones. In it, he placed his sword, within reach of her hand, as ancient custom demanded, so that she could defend herself against whatever there might be. It was near nightfall by the time he completed the mound. In the air above it, he made the sign of Thor's hammer. Not with any hope that it still had power, but for the sake of those old times in which he could never again live. Then, this last of the heroes wept. He had given his goddess her due. Now he grieved for his dead sweetheart. He well knew she was that, too. It should not be supposed that he was in any sense mad. He was a man who had been deeply religious and deeply in love. One last long look at the mound, and he turned his back upon it, thereby making it part of the past, and started toward camp where his men awaited his order to sail. Leaving the grove of trees behind him, he entered the modern age.